Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Robert Atkins, counsel for appellant Becton Dickinson. This Court has warned many times, in fact, and I'd like to quote directly from Your Honor's decision in Doctors Hospital of Jefferson, that the lure of treble damage recovery for otherwise ordinary tort and contract actions has inspired, quote, antitrust lawsuits that do not fulfill the goals of the antitrust law. That is, and I continue to quote, to increase consumer choice, lower prices, and assist competition, not competitors. And in fact, for that very reason, this Court has already answered, in my view, the question that's presented here today. That is, whether unfair competition or business torts can support a treble damage recovery under the Sherman Act. And the Court has addressed it and answered it several times over the last 50 years. With respect to patent infringement in Kinnear Weed, with respect to false and disparaging statements made to eliminate a competitor in Northwest Power, tortious interference intended to destroy a competitor in Deauville, misleading product statements to exclude a competitor from a competitive bidding process in Stearns, and the theft of trade secrets and employees in Taylor. And in fact, it is why I believe Taylor said memorably that the law is rife with examples of disreputable business practices that are not antitrust violations. So the answer here is the same as it has been so many times before in this Court, that unfair competition is still competition on the merits, and that patent infringement, as this Court held long ago in Kinnear Weed and Northwest Power, is not even an injury cognizable under the Sherman Act. And the reason, of course, is the reason so aptly stated by the Court at the top, which is that the antitrust law is for the protection of competition, not competitors.
Is the legal framework that you're urging, focus on disparagement, false advertising, that can never be actionable? Or is it the position that you embraced and suggested at the jury conference that the Harcourt factors, it would only be actionable if the evidence overcame the six factors?
No, our position is that it can only be actionable if it satisfies this court's test in Stearns, which is the economic rationality or profit sacrifice test, which is...
But at the jury conference stage, you were saying Stearns and Taylor meld into the Ninth Circuit Harcourt factors. And you didn't get that instruction.
We didn't get the Stearns instruction, which was straight out of Stearns, not the presumption. What we were saying is that the law in the Ninth Circuit and the law in the Seventh Circuit, in addition, is consistent with and supportive of what I think the law is in this circuit, which under Stearns is that, frankly, any conduct alleged to be anti-competitive, but particularly tortious, suspect, tortious conduct or false advertising, has to meet or fail, whatever the case may be, the Stearns test, which is the conduct cannot be explained other than a short-term loss of profits for the prospect of long-term gain of monopoly power and recoupment through monopoly pricing. But as in Stearns, if the conduct can be explained as the obvious reason in Stearns and the obvious reason here, that the advertiser was seeking to sell its products and it's profitable, as is undisputed here on the record, that BD's advertising and even its product disparagement was profitable, and it was taken to...
The difficulty is, how would a Lanham Act violation ever be a legitimate business endeavor? How could that ever be pro-competitive if it's illegal? So that's the legal...
Because it's illegal with single damages, not treble damages.
Well, I'm asking you what your answer is in terms of... especially if you got a jury instruction that said it had to be consistent with a legitimate business motive.
No, it has to be consistent with short-term profit maximization, which makes it rational. The fact that it's...
But this jury was told that they had to find conduct that made it impossible to compete with no legitimate business purpose.
And that's the general rubric of the rule of reason. Mm-hmm. What they were not instructed on is how this particular highly suspect form of alleged anti-competitive conduct could possibly violate the antitrust laws. And worse, in my view, not only did the court not give the jury guidance about how to answer that particular question, which I think—
You requested.
Which we requested and gave the court an instruction under Stearns. But to me, it's doubly bad because unlike Hornsby and Daugherty, where the jury instructions were found to be error because of the failure to instruct the jury about complex antitrust ideas, what's worse here is not only was the court given no analytic framework, to quote Daugherty, it was given instructions to Judge Jones' point under the Lanham Act. So it was the only false advertising instruction it ever got was the Lanham Act, and then it jumped to damages, and the court said you can only award damages under the antitrust laws. But, Your Honor, though I believe that was error not to instruct the jury, I believe it was legal reversible error requiring judgment for BD that there was no evidence to substantiate the claim satisfy Stearns, namely that the conduct can only be explained by an attempt to exclude a competitor in order to gain monopoly power in some time in the future, charge monopoly prices. And I might add, given that this is an attempt case, bearing in mind that the jury found that BD doesn't have monopoly power, and the juror and the judge found post-trial that BD not only had a declining market share, had a non-dominant declining market share. So we're talking about a non-monopolist, a non-dominant competitor who engages in false advertising. So one, the evidence would have to overcome or satisfy Stearns, and two, it would have to satisfy the second prong in Taylor, which is even if it was irrational and you couldn't explain it other than by an attempt to drive out competition, it has to be the type of conduct that, separate from that, is the kind that is likely to create a substantial likelihood of the acquisition of monopoly power.
That's the second point. What's an example of false advertising that would meet your Stearns instruction?
Well, I'll answer it this way. The expert for the plaintiff gave a hypothetical, which was imagine a market completely unlike this one. Imagine a market with only two competitors. So we're already outside this case. And one of those competitors is a monopolist. Again, not this case. And imagine that the consequence of the monopolist engaging in false advertising is to so substantially increase the cost on the plaintiff that the plaintiff is unable to compete at a competitive price, is driven out of the market, is eliminated from the marketplace, and then you've got the one remaining defendant, the one firm standing, the false advertiser, who can now charge even higher monopoly prices. That was his hypothetical. Now, that's not this case in any way.
I could almost imagine a hypothetical like that for patent infringement, too. So it wouldn't be a per se rule. It would be a pattern of always infringing to keep out possible entrants.
The problem I have with patent infringement as an example is that patent infringement inherently, as this court found in Kinnear-Weed, increases the flow of competition. It may be harmful to the patent holder.
It's good for consumers, even though it's bad for the patent holder.
Right, because now instead of having one product, you have two or three or four.
Are there any cases that hold that a patent infringer is guilty of monopoly or attempt at monopolization?
No, every case that's addressed it, and it's not many, because for the obvious reason. But the cases that have addressed it have all held it's not actionable. And of course, not with the same strength and force as this court did, but no one's adopted patent infringement as an
Now, you're not making much of an attack on the Lanham Act verdict, right?
Well, we are because the claim was barred by res judicata and laches. So we're not contesting the liability finding. It was hotly debated at trial, but on appeal, the Lanham Act judgment should be reversed on res judicata grounds under the court's decision in Oreck. And if I can address that, I think it's completely uncontested that the advertising that was as issue in this case was the same as the advertising that was issue in the party's original lawsuit, which was settled and dismissed with prejudice.
I understand that, but their argument here is that these advertisements continued to be disseminated.
Right, and that's exactly the issue this court decided in Oreck. In Orrick, you had, it's very much like this case, two advertising claims, only one of which, by the way, was at issue in the first lawsuit. In our case, both of the advertising claims were at issue. As soon as the case was settled and dismissed, the advertising claim that was at issue in the first suit continued during the subsequent time period, and the Fifth Circuit held under the very orthodox application of the transactional test for claim preclusion that a continuation of the same conduct doesn't give rise to a new cause of action because it arises out of the same transaction or occurrences or the same nucleus of operative facts. I mean, frankly, Orrick couldn't be more squarely on point. In fact, it even presents the question, which I think they might be arguing, that though the advertising claims are the same, they might have appeared in different forms. And that's also exactly the issue that was decided in Orrick, which was the no-loss suction claim that was at issue in the first lawsuit was embodied in advertisements directed at retailers. Subsequent to the settlement and dismissal, it found its way into advertisements directed at consumers, which you might imagine is a substantial change. The court, and I'm quoting the court on this, said there's no merit in that argument, and there's no merit to the argument that the claims that appeared subsequent to the settlement constitute, quote, future claims.
Could I take you back to the antitrust point?
Of course.
Two questions. The Stearns instruction that you requested but didn't get, if that were to be found by us to be reversible error, would that be in tension at all with the second, the sixth, the ninth that have this multi-factor test, or was your instruction the equivalent of that?
No, our instruction was the equivalent of Stearns.
And it was the equivalent of Stearns. And is Stearns in harmony with these other circuits or not?
I would say they are in harmony. I would say that you know, the law actually is, I mean, my view, and I know this will seem self-serving, the Fifth Circuit, in my view, has got it exactly right, which is there's no absolute barrier to any claim, but there are tests. There's below-cost pricing for predatory pricing. There's the Stearns test for tortious conduct. I think other courts are grappling with how to deal with torts and false advertising. The Seventh Circuit said, you know, don't even try. And the other courts have adopted a presumption of a de minimis impact. But what they all share in common, including sharing in common with this court's jurisprudence, is that ordinary business torts that harm competitors but not competition are highly unlikely to contribute to the acquisition of monopoly power.
What role did the question of general purchase orders play at trial in regard to monopolization?
Your Honor, I honestly don't understand your question.
The contracts between BD and...
The group purchasing organizations.
Group purchasing, right.
That was tried to the jury. There were...
Those were
all rejected by the jury. The jury found that all the claims of anti-competitive contracting, bundling discounts, market share rebates, exclusive dealing under Sherman 1 and Sherman 2 were all rejected by the jury.
And those were not argued as separate, as part of the congeries of grounds that would have gone into monopolization?
They were argued as a standalone monopolization claim that was rejected, and I suppose a standalone attempted monopolization claim. What we're talking about today...
Right, I understand. So yes. I looked at the closing arguments, and it looked to me as if there was, you know, 75% of the closing argument was devoted to these contracts, so...
Well, that was true, and part of that was because I was making the argument, so I ate up a lot of the clock. But yes, that was the centerpiece of the dispute between these two companies has been for a very long time about contracting practices in principally the hospital market. And those claims were the burden of the trial and the burden of the antitrust claims. And those the jury rejected.
Well, which is the claim? What was the claim that was settled for $150 million?
There was a claim that was settled in a prior lawsuit involving a different earlier generation of GPO contracts that have different features and
was
different.
That BD is
the. That was BD. It was 100, just to make the record clear.
Okay, and then the patent infringement was $5 million.
That was a $5 million judgment.
Okay.
So. So All that remains are these Lanham Act claims, which, as I think you know from the papers, the plaintiffs chose to abandon as a damages claim at trial. And it seems quite clear to me that the consequence of that was that the jury, having nowhere to go, because they dropped the request for damages under the Lanham Act, the judge didn't give them any kind of guidance about false advertising, if there is such a thing, under the antitrust laws, and said in his instructions, you can only award damages under the antitrust laws. And that's what brings us here today.
Back on the Stearns point, our Multiflex versus Samuel Moore decision.
Yes.
It's got language that suggests that freezing out exclusionary conduct could include disparagement of a product as inferior.
It says it could, and I'm not shutting the door and locking it. I think it's universally recognized in the law that false advertising is highly unlikely to contribute to the acquisition of monopoly power. But what's to me correct about the law in this circuit is they have a test, an objective test, which is the Stearns test, for determining whether it is or it isn't. And importantly, that test serves the function of avoiding what the law surely should avoid, which is false positives, which is penalizing with treble damages conduct that might be aggressive, might be unfair, but only harms a single competitor. If I could just highlight the point.
Maybe you should highlight in your rebuttal.
And then I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Hardin. It's hard to resist asking whether your client has made more out of lawsuits than they ever could have made from more sales of the syringes.
Roy Hardin for Retractable Technologies, Your Honor. The money from those lawsuits is the only reason I'm standing here, Your Honor, because without that money, they've been driven out of business. The difference between a tort lawsuit and a Sherman Act lawsuit is very clear because of this court's decision in Multiflex v. Moore. This court put four markers down that tell us when we're dealing with an antitrust case and not just a tort case. Marker one is a dominant player in a concentrated market. There it was blowout protection hoses. Here, it's the safety syringe market where three players control 90% of the market and BD always had 50% or more. The second marker, importantly, is specific intent to monopolize in an attempt case. Now, Multiflex teaches that this element sets an attempt case apart from even a Section 1 case because even a restraint not sufficient for Section 1 can constitute an attempt if specific intent is shown. Now, the jury was said, is specific intent to monopolize? The jury was told it is the conscious aim of acquiring power to control price or exclude competition. It's interesting and important in this case that Beck and Dickinson never contested in this appeal that it had a conscious aim of acquiring power to control price or exclude competition. We noted this to them in our response brief. We said they have not contested a specific intent to monopolize. They said nothing in their reply brief. If counsel says something here today, it's brand new argument. Now, that informs the entire set of circumstances because we're not talking about just false advertising or patent infringement. We're talking about a course of conduct by a dominant player who controlled the market with yesterday's technology and wanted to make sure that today's technology couldn't get in the marketplace. And it did so by disparaging that technology and lying about it, which was just what happened in Multiflex, Your Honor.
Multiflex, the language is thin. I guess my questions to you, I have a set, but if one is, why isn't Judge Easterbrook in his sequence from, I can't pronounce it well, Sitar all the way to Sanderson right, that virtually any false advertising, and once I put in the word virtually, that's making it ambiguous. He says it's just warfare. It's hyper-competitive, but cannot be actionable. Now, I don't hear your opponent requesting that absolute bar. He specifically said no. But then if you don't, and I'll get a question to you, if you don't accept that Seventh Circuit authority, why wouldn't it have been reversible error not to embrace the Harcourt presumption that the evidence has got to establish all six factors to set a very high bar for when it's not hyper-competitive, but in fact is against all competition, not one competitor?
This court has not adopted those six factors. I would propose to Your Honor that these facts would meet those six factors for sure.
Yeah.
But this court uses the test in Taylor Publishing and Multiflex, which is the question is whether or not the competition was on the merits or not. If it was not on the merits, was it capable of delivering monopoly power? The power to set price or exclude competition. That's the test. And that's the test of the Supreme Court.
So basically all you're saying, if a company is big and you can produce some internal emails that said, we want to take over this market, that you get to go to the jury.
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. Because that's not all they did. What they did was they harmed consumers and they harm the marketplace.
Did you produce evidence of a single consumer who was confused, misled, or did not purchase RTI syringes because of your false advertising?
No direct evidence.
False advertising?
No direct evidence, Your Honor. However, the indirect evidence was powerful. BD's own internal records said this type of technology, this syringe technology, should take 50% of the market easily. That was in 2005. When they discovered that they couldn't innovate, they decided to put a stop to that.
Well, what bothers me about false advertising here is that you are not dealing with a market of schmoes who want to have a Sonic burger versus a McDonald's burger. You're dealing with people who use syringes. And therefore, this claim about one needle being sharper than another is something that you may have your scientific tests about sharpness, but the ultimate test is how does the patient feel when they're stuck? And you can, you know, the people who are the purchasers in the hospitals can find that out.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, that's the when you have an ad that tells people that we're the oldest company, we have the sharpest needle, and they know that they don't. That the historical fact that they were a 100-year-old company saying to people, we have scientific tests showing that we're sharper, and if you try someone else's needle, it'll be more painful on your patient. That's the truth about medical professionals. They don't want to take any risk of harming a patient. So they will do what the advertising says, and that's what happened here, and that's what BD banked on, while knowingly lying about it for years. In part to keep out newcomers into a marketplace that was controlled by three parties. My client was the only newcomer in 10 years. Now, that's not competition on the merits. It is, and it affected the marketplace. Those lies internally were shown to have great effect in premium pricing.
You know, I mean, there's a reason, isn't there, why Congress passed the Lanham Act to prescribe damages for false advertising and trademark infringement and all that sort of thing, right? And Congress also passed the Sherman Act. And basically you're saying, I don't see what differentiates your case from any other false advertising case. We can't conflate them.
I'm not conflating them. When I'm in addition to a false advertising case. This is a case of a dominant player in a concentrated market who had the specific intent to keep new products out and keep their own profit margins high. The evidence was that that's exactly what they did. They kept the profit margins high using false advertising. They didn't allow product in, so that even though they said it should take 50% of the market, it never got, the retracting syringes never got to more than 5%.
Well, actually what they did was they introduced their own competitive 1 millimeter and 3 millimeter syringes so that they would take more of the market by, quote, competing.
They probably did that initially, Your Honor, but then when that product didn't work, when it was a lemon in the marketplace and their engineers screamed to take it off, they left it in.
Yeah,
that's not rational.
They sold a bunch.
They sold very few. They sold very few. The damages in the patent infringement part of this case were $5 million because they didn't sell many. They didn't want to sell many.
But they still had I forget which one it was, but I think the 3mm remained on the market, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. They escaped patent infringement by making it two pieces, which caused it to leak. There was video at trial showing that someone's trying to use it and it's leaking. The engineers said, we can fix that, management. Give us a penny, we'll put a washer in it. They were not allowed to fix it. Now, that's not logical, rational conduct.
And so what was the reason for selling, wasting your money manufacturing and selling a product that no one wanted to buy? What was the reason for that?
The reason was to pollute and taint the market against new technology that would take away profits from old technology.
So then how are they going to roll out? I mean, what's the logic of this? How are they going to roll out the new one, and having kept a leaking one on the market for 10 years? 2015, or whenever it is, the patent runs out for RTI, and then you're going to start producing RTI's product. And now you're going to say it's ours and we're better?
Sure.
How? How stupid are consumers?
Brand new technology. Well, when you have...
new technology, it's RTI.
When you have market power, which they certainly do, they can certainly come out, look, car companies come out with bad hybrids and they come out with good hybrids. That's going to happen. For sure it's going to happen. When it happens, Your Honor, what will happen is there'll be less competition because my client was kept down.
Aside from this case, what other cases are there where the patent infringer, as opposed to the patentee, has succeeded in a monopolization claim?
There aren't any, Your Honor, but this case is not based on the patentee, on the patent conduct itself. The conduct, there's no case saying the patent conduct is exempt. The conduct of making things is exempt from antitrust scrutiny. The question is, and always is in an antitrust case, what was the effect of the conduct?
So your theory on that, as argued to the jury, was that they infringed the patent so that they could produce, and then they infringed the patent, which you would, as a matter of law, doesn't violate the antitrust laws. But B, they did it so they could produce a crummy product so that C, someday they could take over the market by producing the patented object.
The jury heard that evidence, Your Honor.
And they accepted it.
Accepted that evidence. Because of live testimony from the stand where they could judge credibility.
How do we write an opinion for this court affirming this judgment that the objective business reporter isn't going to laugh at?
Easily.
Give me another example in American business history of I know you say, and I'm really actually serious, I'm not just being sarcastic, of a monopolist producing a bad product so that it can spoil the market for competition and then produce precisely the same product as the competition later on.
Well, but for the last chunk, Microsoft did a very similar thing. Microsoft created a software product that it knew didn't perform as advertised, put it in the market to block new products. So the fact that a monopolist or a near monopolist like BD would use products as part of a scheme to keep newcomers out is not a new thought, Your Honor. It's not at all. Now, the fact that there was they say they're not going to put a new retractable in. The point of the scheme to do that is the important point, which is they had specific intent to run my client out of business. That's the issue in an attempt case, not whether they actually did it. The question is, did they have specific intent? And that report, called the LCR report, showed that they thought my client's finances were weak, its patents would expire, and that'll be the time, if we want to, we can run them out with a better retractable. The jury heard that and understood and found, and BD has not contested here on appeal, that meant that BD had a specific intent, not just to compete, as they now say, but to obtain power to control prices and exclude competition, which is exactly what they were doing.
My first question was any thoughts you have on the line of seconds. Do you agree that the Seventh Circuit would never allow this to be actionable?
Well, the Seventh Circuit in a case after the Sanderson case, a case called Mercatus.
Arcatus?
Mercatus. backed off of that just a little and indicated that that there could be possible. It could be possible.
I guess, you know, even with Multiflex out there, Easterbrook's decisions have sort of power in that it's hard to see even reprehensible false advertising, which I would think of as hyper-competitive, wrongly competitive, but maybe not actionable. It's going to, you know, if they target RTI and then have liability for that, still others will come in because RTI is being hurt. Even if you don't accept the Seventh Circuit, and we haven't, I was startled at the proposed jury instruction stage that you strongly oppose the multi-factor test, which would embrace and guide a jury to understand if it's sophisticated customers and easy to neutralize, that doesn't make for an antitrust case.
Well, Your Honor, this court, we believe the Stearns case really was not a case that was about antitrust in this sense. There was no finding in that case that there was a closed market. I mean, that case said that there were foreign competitors could come in easily. There was no discussion of an actual specific intent to monopolize in Stearns. And the conduct that was said to be happening there was all conduct found to be on the merits. So the four markers, which are specific intent, conduct not on the merits, dangerous probability, and a closed market, none of those were present in Stearns. So it's absolutely, Stearns was a beauty contest between.
Stearns says, quote, all of these arguments made by the defendant to its potential customers may have been wrong, misleading, or debatable, close quote. Well, on the merit, I don't, you know, from the standpoint of the impact on your competitor, a wrong, misleading, or debatable concept, particularly wrong and misleading, can be just as harmful as a false one.
In Stearns, Your Honor, there wasn't the context of, there weren't these other four factors that were that were in Multiflex. In Multiflex, they found that the conduct was disparaging the quality of the Multiflex product, overstating the pressure ratings of its own competing product, and advising potential customers the company had no customers.
But that case, like the cases you urged to the district court at the jury instruction, it seems that it's part and parcel of a larger whole of other anti-competitive conduct, which then we didn't discuss before, but the Associated Radio case has, for me, conceptually a hard proposition that each individual can't be sufficient, but the whole can. But then you get the special verdict here, and it reduces down to false advertising and patent infringement.
Well,
wrong?
Can I address that, Your Honor?
Yes, I'd love to.
Because it doesn't.
It doesn't, okay.
It doesn't. There was plenty of other conduct. That's what BD would like to say, this case is about false advertising and patent infringement. Not so. It's really about lies and disparagement. Those same lies were used to create spreadsheets to stop big customers like Walmart from buying our product. It wasn't in advertising. They also sent out salespeople. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
They sent out salespeople with similar lies. So this was just behind the door lying and disparaging,
well,
just as
respect,
present
sir.
Here,
well,
not just advertising.
Well, but the jury verdict rests on patent infringement and false advertising.
No, with all respect, Your Honor, the jury's verdict said deception only. It didn't say anything about the verdict didn't say anything about false advertising.
All right, fine. But your closing argument said very little about the salesman. It said a whole lot about the false, the waste space and the sharpness.
Well, let me make clear. Those lies about the waste space and sharpness were not just in false advertisements out for everyone to see. They were used in calculations put into spreadsheet and handed to Walgreens and Walmart, telling those customers that if you use RTI, you'll lose $4 million in medicine. You can get our product for free, basically. If RTI gives you their product, they could give you their product and our product would be cheaper. That's not advertising. That's disparaging lies behind the scenes, which was happening.
Let me ask you.
Can I have one more conduct point?
Sure.
Thank you, Your
Honor. I have an important question, though. So.
Okay. The other conduct point, which the jury heard, was if you want to stop innovation from happening, one thing you do is make sure nobody thinks you need it. And so what Becton Dickinson...
Nobody thinks you
what? No one thinks you need innovation. What Becton Dickinson said was all these products are equally safe. And yet they knew, they were receiving reports from hospitals that their non-retracting syringes were not working. There was statistical evidence showing that after sales of all those products, needle sticks had not gone down at all.
Well, there was also a federal report about needle sticks. And, you know, this common sense response to what you're saying is if the hospitals thought that the BD needles were not performing adequately, then the hospitals would have looked for the competing product.
And when they looked for competing products, they'd find that, well, that product could hurt my patients because its needle is duller and it's going to waste medication.
Let's move back to the Lanham Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they don't, you know, again, we'll look at the defenses, but suppose we reject those defenses and the case has to proceed on Lanham Act damages, I would take it that would require a new trial.
It would require a recalculation of the disparagement number, yes, Your Honor.
Well, it would be, was there any evidence at trial that could be used on Lanham Act damages alone?
Yes, Your Honor. So for Lanham Act damages, for the disgorgement number, the law is that we had to put in the revenues obtained from the bad acts, and we did that. They put in their costs. So the costs were put in and the revenue was put in. And we gave Judge Davis numbers. His conclusion was that was subsumed, that amount, whatever it was subsumed in the antitrust verdict.
Okay.
Lastly, I just want to point out to this court one thing with my remaining 16 seconds. That is that what we have here is a dominant player in concentrated markets. And dominant players in concentrated markets need to know that the answer to innovation, when innovation comes and disrupts your market, the answer is more innovation, not aggressive deception.
Let me ask you one other question, though, because the other principal argument here from a policy standpoint is that all you showed was injury to a competitor, not injury to competition, because there were other products, Covidien and that other product, in the market as well. So how were they injured by BD?
Well, they were injured, the Covidien and the others were injured as well by the claims of saving waste space and sharpness. They were as false to those as they were to us. But the injury really was the consumers paid higher prices. One of the things that antitrust is supposed to protect against, they paid higher prices for things they didn't get, sharpness and savings of medication. And the industry suffered needle sticks at the same rate as before these products came on the market and didn't get the advantage of innovation.
Okay.
Innovation, quality, and price.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just start clearing one thing up. On the post-trial motion by RTI to have the judge reverse the jury and declare BD to have engaged in actual monopolization, the judge found, and this is at page 6945 of the record, that BD has a non-dominant declining market share. And BD's market share was not 50%, it was less than 50%. So there should be no doubt about that BD is not a monopolist, not dominant, and its market share was declining during this period of so-called anti-competitive conduct. As to competition on the merits, I think there's a misnomer here. Competition on the merits doesn't mean false advertising violates the antitrust laws because it's not meritorious. Competition on the merits means that it is conduct that may be unfair, may be false, may be misleading, but it is typical, and now I'm quoting from Stearns, typical of ordinary practices used in a competitive market. That is to say, it is not an indication of an attempt to exclude or monopolize. And it is hard to think of any conduct that's any more ubiquitous in competitive markets than false advertising. Indeed, it is probably empirically the case that there's more false advertising, the more competition there is. But suffice it to say that false advertising is not an indicator of a lack of competition, a harm to competition, and under Stearns, unless it's done for the sacrifice of short-term profits, it's not anti-competitive conduct. Which leads us to something that I wanted to mention, didn't get a chance, which was antitrust injury, which is an independent ground for reversal here. The injury claimed here is not, as it must be under Brunswick and your authorities, an injury that flows from a harm to competition, from conduct that's prohibited by the Sherman Act. And the best evidence of that on this record is that their measure of injury, their measure of damages, is classic false advertising damages. What sales would the company have made had the false advertisements not run? Their expert, Mr. Manis, assumed that in the but-for world, there would be less competition, not more. He assumed that BD would no longer make a retractable. He assumed there would be no new entry. And he assumed that prices would not go down, but in fact would that RTI's prices would in fact stay at their high, way above market level. So what he was calculating was Lanham Act damages. Let's keep the market exactly as it is, make it a little even less competitive, take away BD, and take away the ads, and what do you get? That's not a measure of an antitrust injury. A measure of an antitrust injury is of a market where there's more competition, not less. So as a matter of law, there is an abject failure of proof to demonstrate antitrust injury, and on those grounds alone.
That's sort of the flip of your liability argument, though.
Well, it's a flip or it's a pairing of it.
And we've applied Brunswick, one case I was on, Wagoner,
yes,
and Jabacco. Those are situations where you aren't even a direct competitor. So I don't find a case right on point.
And it, well,
it is hard for me to see how this argument's actually separate than the first.
Well, Brunswick is directly on point.
Brunswick
is a case in which the supposition by the plaintiff is that absent the merger, my competition would have gone out of business, and I would have faced less competition,
injuries,
and I want those damages.
Injury standing does get competitor-specific, not competition.
Well, oftentimes antitrust injury is used as a rubric to cover both what I'm talking about, which is, does the injury claim flow from a harm to competition? It's also used sometimes as a standing requirement, as in the Chewbacca case.
With your time getting close.
Yes.
Of course, you're stressing Stearns. But Stearns, it is different in the airport case. It was acknowledged that the argument the court made was that the competitor could neutralize, could counteract, right? Because the claims weren't illegal ones. The advertising wasn't illegal. It's hard. You couldn't say RTI could falsely respond, right?
Well, one could, but
that's, that gets difficult.
Understood. But that's not the doctrinal foundation of Stearns. I mean, the doctrinal foundation of Stearns is not, like under some of these presumption cases, maybe they could offset it. The doctrinal foundation is we need an objective economic test to distinguish between conduct that may be aggressive and maybe even unlawful under a different statute, but that is not conduct that can only be explained by an attempt to exclude a competitor and acquire monopoly power. And when that conduct, no matter how unfair, indeed malicious in the language of Brook Group from the Supreme Court, no matter how unfair, can be explained by an attempt by a company to better its own business, to increase its own sales, in the words of Stearns, to advance its own business for the obvious reason of selling products, then it cannot be anti-competitive conduct. And that's what the record here shows was the case. That it was not anti-competitive conduct. If you permit me, maybe you won't.
No.
Okay.
Be fair.
That's fair.
All right. Thank you
very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. Court will be in recess until 9:00 tomorrow morning.